I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a special edition of the Wonder Root podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with John Carroll and Laura Relier, the co-curators of the Transgression Literary Series. Laura, John, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Let's talk about Transgression. What our listeners are about to hear is Volume 2 of the Transgression series. Let's talk about the origins of what Transgression is and maybe how you all kind of hatched this idea. John.
Well, Transgression, it definitely changes, but we've went from just being kind of just a normal literary series with kind of off-the-wall ideas to being an immersive reading series. And what we mean by that is we want to interact with the audience as much as possible and want them to be able to participate and to be able to not just sit in a chair for an hour and hear readers, which we both have come from traditional reading series and we really enjoy those, but we just wanted to do something different with Transgression.
Laura?
Yeah, I think our main focus at the inception of Transgression, what we wanted to do was kind of just bring literature to life. So we pick stories that are accessible and entertaining and kind of often spooky, and kind of think about how we can, like Johnny said, completely immerse our audience in the experience of a story rather than being a witness.
Okay. So for all of our listeners out there, you are in for a treat. You're actually about to hear Volume 2. Born Under a Bad Sign is the name of that volume, Volume 2 of the Transgression series. John, could you give us the lineup of the artists who are involved with this volume?
I feel like this is an exam at school. The lineup was going to be Nick Tikoski, who's one of the hosts of Write Club. And he's reading from, he's acting out the part of Popeye from William Faulkner's Sanctuary. And then we also have Travis Broyles, who plays Boo Radley, and Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Two for two here. From there, we have Kristen Conger, who was in A Good Man's Hard to Find, written by Flannery O'Connor, and she actually is playing the Misfit. From there, we have Derek Prawl doing James Dickey's Deliverance. And we actually, on that one, that was pretty fun. We actually just went ahead and combined all of the Mountain Men. If you go through and look at the book and look at the movie, there's just Mountain Men as a role, or Mountain Man. So we decided to say, hey, just embody all of that. From there, we have Elizabeth Jarrett. She played Bonnie D. Peacock in Eudora Welty's The Ponder Heart. And that is our lineup that you're going to be hearing on the podcast here.
Now, as a point of reference, this volume of the series was first performed at Phoenix Fest, right?
No, was actually performed at Villa de Grip.
Oh, okay.
Which is, it's kind of this mysterious warehouse. We try to always do our readings in spaces that maybe aren't as notorious for having events, to kind of give extra exposure to, like, these really amazing creative spaces around Atlanta. Villa de Grip, you may know it as, like, these, like, ominous carriage doors that are across the street from Freedy and also Pure Taqueria on the corner of Highland and Elizabeth. It's essentially, there are all sorts of, like, there are grips who do, like, for film, they do a lot of build-out for set design and stuff. There are sculptors in there, puppeteers. It's where Raymond Carr built the Spaceman from the Scout Mob Halloween party a couple of years ago. So it's a great little nexus of creativity that we just wanted to kind of open to the public for an evening. And the theme, in case you couldn't tell from the lineup, we wanted to bring Southern Gothic literature to life. So that was kind of where we sourced all of our prompt material from, was that genre.
So. Now, I know I mentioned the Phoenix Fest. Mm-hmm. Transgression has been a part of the Phoenix Fest in the past, correct?
Yes, most recently.
So just wanted to.
And technically, the first Transgression reading was actually at the first Phoenix Fest.
Okay,
in 2014.
Just wanted to make sure.
At Urban Sprout Farm, we collected 5 or 6 readers just to kind of do just a little quick little mini launch, let people know that we were around. And then that was Phoenix Fest 2014, and then this past Phoenix Fest, this last month, we did our first installation. So that was volume 3, and that was called Mass Hysteria. What was the tagline for it?
Oh, gosh. It was really long.
Yeah, we always do these really long taglines. Just check out the website.
But we had contributions from, I think it was around 40 different?
40 different writers and artists. And I just remembered the tagline.
Oh, what was the tagline?
A literary installation of collective delusions.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun.
Laura made a funny comment about our topics being spooky, but I feel like they are. They're all macabre.
It's like
you almost... It's either, I don't know, if we're both sick and twisted or if what's
maybe
happening
mostly
there.
You. I'm just kidding. We're both, maybe if those
like true. Getting out our dark side with our reading series.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, the last question that I have for you before we actually hear this volume is, when you were curating the lineup, how did you all go about selecting the artists who were going to participate?
For this one, I think we kind of... We developed which characters we wanted to come to life first, and then kind of, it was almost like we put on our casting director hats on and we're like, who could do this, you know, and kind of combed through different writers and performers who we had seen before to see who might be a good fit. And we always kind of have like, you know, 2 to 3 people in our pocket for each role, especially in this instance, just based on availability, especially since it happened in May. It's kind of a busy time for a lot of people. But we ended up having kind of a dream team. I mean, everyone was incredibly riveting and, common word, spooky.
I don't know if you enjoy these, but our concept meetings are always really fun because we have a really great working relationship, Laura and I. And so, it's kind of on the table that you can just veto things. You can just call it out and you can fight on it. You know, if you want somebody to do something or you want to cover a certain book or certain character, you can put a stake in. So we have, I enjoy that process. So we really work well together in that process of figuring out who's the best. And, you know, sometimes it's luck and sometimes it's availability. But yeah, so far, I mean, all 3 volumes have been amazing and we couldn't have asked for a better cast for any of them. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I'll let you two do the honors and throw to the actual readings for this volume. So, Laura, John, feel free to set it up.
How do we set this up?
I don't know.
Ladies and gentlemen, born under a bad sign.
What he said. I don't know. I mean, I don't really know how to add to that. He just said it.
What he said.
What he said.
What he said. Hope you all enjoy.
A Place of Fermentation by Nicholas Tachosky. Something is going to happen to you. I watched the dense underbrush, thorn bushes and milkweed, the oaks and the Spanish moss, creating a dense canopy over the road, blotting out the late day sun. And you stumble through. You stumble right through it with that swine and wolf's clothing, that specimen of manhood, this gentleman drunkard. Trained so in Virginia, I heard him say. It carried through the wood, and he said it over and over, as if it were a point of pride. Trained to drink in Virginia. Very proper. Deeply impressive. Certainly, a Virginia origin makes a destiny at the bottom of the bottle that much more noble. The bottom of the bottle is what led you here. What led to the noise and violence of your vehicle striking a well-placed tree in the road? A trap. Admittedly crude, you were not what I was expecting to catch, but I will claim you nonetheless. My grizzled cohort leads the two of you down the road. Your bloodied paramour walks beside him, and I watch you follow, wrapping your gentility tightly about you, even as you fumble into this place in those slippers that have no business touching Mississippi mud. I'm impressed that you hold your head so high, that your spine remains so straight. If it weren't for your eyes, I'd suspect you were made of steel. But I see it in those eyes. You know you've chosen your path poorly. Behind that pretty face, your mind is racing, tracing your decisions back to the critical moment. You shouldn't have gotten out of the car back down the road. You should have waited for help to arrive, as surely it would, or further back. You shouldn't have gotten into the car in the first place. Shouldn't have even agreed to the date. You should have just said no the 15th time he asked you out, as you had the previous 14. You never should have gone to that university. You'd had so many choices before you. You could have gone to New York, to Annapolis. You could have followed that sweet, dull boy to Houston. He loved you in his sweet, dull way. And Houston, that's where he ended up. And you could be there, right now, beside him in the library, preparing yourself for a sweet, dull life as a pharmacist's wife. The future would stretch out before you, everything in its place, nothing surprising, no curves in the road ahead. Each weekday, you would help him out at the register. In the evening, you'd hurry home to cook him dinner. You would raise his children in a quiet neighborhood. Spend your Saturdays listening to the biddies drone on while planning the next fundraiser for the local chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Spend Sunday morning on your knees. You could be safe. Instead of here, in this place, with this gentleman drunkard tripping blithely through purgatory and straight on to perdition. You could still turn around, but you will not. Because despite the danger you're being placed in, despite your fear, you are polite. You feel obligated to treat my filthy, tattered colleague as if he does not instill the fear of God in you. It is clear that you were brought up well. But this is not a place to be polite. This is a place of fermentation. Here we take the natural, the unspoiled, the sweet, and we push it into the darkness. And then we apply heat. And we apply pressure. So much that it is impossible for the subject to retain its original form. So much that it defies belief. We distill what was once sweet into liquid fire, into poison. We take this bitter brew and bottle it and send it back out into the wide world, where it sits, festering until some gentleman drunkard or another uncorks it. We pollute. We destroy. We profit. This is a place of transformation, and I am its key agent. I watch the two of you follow my colleague as he climbs onto the graying porch of the old house, watch you peer through the empty sockets of its windows before dutifully walking after him into its dark maw. I am in awe of how your proper upbringing gets in the way of your self-preservation. I will join you shortly. If I was a different kind of monster, I might feel something different in this moment. Pity. Mercy. But I only feel hungry, and I have work to do. Something is going to happen to you. It is already happening, and you don't even feel it.
You never really know a man until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb inside of his skin and walk around in it. Are we poor? Are we as poor as the Cunninghams? Everybody knows Cunninghams won't take nothing from nobody. Any fool could have told her that. I remember when my daddy got me that gun. Never point at anything in the house. Shoot at tin cans in the backyard. You know, tell them... Tell them about the time Boo tried to kill his papa. While standing in the yard one day when his mama come out yelling, "He's killing us all! He's killing us all!" There's a lot of ugly things in this world, son. I wish I could keep them all away from you. But that's never possible. He only comes out at night, when you're asleep and it's pitch dark. When you wake up at night, you can hear him, once I hears him scratching on our screen door. But he was gone by the time Atticus got here. I wonder what he does in there. I wonder what he looks like. Well, judging from his tracks, he's about 6.5 feet tall. He eats raw squirrels and all the cats he can catch. There's a long, jagged scar that runs all the way across his face. His teeth are yellow and rotten. His eyes are popped, and he drools most of the time. Do you know what compromise is? Bending the law. Well, tell them about the time Boo tried to kill his papa. For God's sakes, Mr. Finch, he's got to be killed right away before he starts running. Well, I was standing in the yard one day when his mama come out yelling, "He's killing us all." Turned out Boo was sitting in the living room cutting up the paper for his scrapbook, and when his daddy come by, he reached over with his scissors and stabbed him in his leg. Pulled him out and kept right on cutting the paper. They wanted to send him to an asylum, but his daddy said, "No Radley is going to any asylum." So they locked him up in the basement of the courthouse till he nearly died of the damp, and his daddy brought him back home. There he is to this day, sitting over there with his scissors. Lord knows what he's doing or thinking. Tin cans. He said that sooner or later he'd suppose the temptation to go after birds would be too much. That I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. Don't go near that dog, you understand? He's just as dangerous dead as he is alive. I'm the only father you have. You wouldn't want me to go and get my head knocked off, would you? No Radley is going to any asylum.
I'm Kristen Conger, and this is my piece for the Transgression series, based off the Flannery O'Connor short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find. And this is the backstory of the serial killer, the Misfit.
It was Peggy Dunn first called me the Misfit. Or I reckon, in the interest of accuracy, it weren't exactly me she was calling the Misfit. And I apologize to all you ladies in the room for what I'm about to say, but who, or rather what, Peggy called the Misfit was my Ding Wallace, or what my mama, God rest her soul, referred to as the devil's fiddle string. You boys better keep your devil's fiddle strings from getting all knotted up where it don't belong, you hear? She told my brother Donald me after Donald went and ruined one of my Sunday socks. Course I didn't snitch on Donald. Jesus directed to resist an evil person and turn the other cheek. Besides, Donald would have beat the tar out of me. So I let Mama think it was me and went to church naked footed on my right shoe till I got a new pair for Christmas. Look at it. Just a little old misfit, Peggy said, snickering at it the first time she and I come to know each other biblically. It was on our wedding night, on account as Peggy refused to let me look at anything more than her titties when we wasn't married. And I could have waited, but curiosity just eats at a feller, her body poking in and out in all the correct places. First time I saw her, she was spinning around on one of them horse tornadoes. You know those merry-go-rounds all lit up and making music out of nowheres? There Peggy was, just spinning and spinning around, so's all I could really make out was her teeth flashing bright white every time that dead-eyed butterscotch pony galloped back around to where I was standing. I like a good set of teeth on a woman. That way, in case anything happens to 'em, like somebody points a gun and shoots him off a dead-eyed pony, and she breaks her pretty little head open, and a heap of other dead-eyed ponies comes a-galloping up from behind and tramples that pretty little body into a mess of tissue and bone and crow-black hair, matted all witch-a-ways. Folks can still know who it is by her teeth. Living folks can lie through theirs teeth, but dead folks' teeth don't lie. As soon as that horse tornado stopped, I walked over to where Peggy was and said, "Howdy there, miss." She started a bit, given I was standing directly behind her, just kind of looking down at her little hairdo. Even had a tuckered out daisy poked behind her left ear, real cutesy-like. Them two girls with her giggled as if I'd untold a joke or poked a turkey feather under their noses. "Well, howdy there," Peggy said back to me, fluttering her lashes like her eyes had gone dry. Now, I ain't a fool. I knew it had to be the soldier's uniform that done it, got her to say howdy back. I just got off the train at Calhoun on my way back after leaving the armed services, belongings slung over my shoulder and everything. And in that time, whether a feller had killed a Nazi or not, a uniform sure helped with the ladies. Now, I best reckon you spect I weren't too good with the ladies on account as I've shot to death around about 9 or 13 folks, depending on whether you's counting children and the elderly. And then I done it as easy as shelling butter beans in the summertime. Pop, pop, pop. Well, guess what? You're wrong. Now, see, back when I met Peggy, I was gentler than a gnat in April. Made girls nervous how nice I was. One time at a church picnic, the preacher's daughter was eating a mustard and onion sandwich, and she got a streak of yeller on her cheek, so I did what any gentleman would do. Snuck up to her and wiped her face with my red bandana. And what'd she do in return? Scream loud enough would have made Jesus on the cross plug his ears. But Peggy was different. She wasn't like all them other girls. A good woman is hard to find, but I thought I'd done found her. "Why do you leave the army?" she asked me first time I come to quarter. We were sitting next to the creek behind her house, her daddy in mud-stained overalls watching us through the screen door. It was hot as Hades that day, sweat carving out the Mississippi Delta across my back. I just didn't want to kill nobody, I told her, figuring she'd up and leave me right then. But Peggy didn't get up to leave. She reached her little hand as soft as a cat's paw over to mine and took it. My mom and daddy weren't so keen on me getting married, of course. My daddy never took much a liking to me anyhow, always favored Donald over me, looked at the pair of us like Cain and Abel, never could do nothing right for daddy, especially after that hunting trip. See, when it came my turn to pull the trigger on a deer in our sight lines, my finger just took to trembling. "Shoot it, boy," daddy hissed in my ear. "If you let that stag get away, I'm going to skin your little sissy hide right off of you." But that just started me crying, so he snatched the rifle out of my hand, passed it over to Donald quick as he could. And Donald shot that deer plumb between the eyes, and Daddy didn't look at me for the rest of the day. Boy can't even shoot a deer or a Nazi and thinks he's man enough to marry some girl, my daddy crowed the night I told him Peggy and I was getting hitched. Wait till I tell Donald. He's going to have himself a shit fit. Peggy and I didn't care if our parents thought we was jumping the gun, so to speak. By then, I had got me a job assisting at the railroad station, and Peggy'd almost finished high school. And that first night after we was wed at the courthouse, Peggy named my pecker the Misfit, and the nickname just kind of stuck all over me. She might nudge me in church and whisper, "Time to kneel, Misfit." Or at the general store might say, "Go order me a pound of flour, Misfit." It was like she was telling me a secret that nobody would understand, even if they heard. Things was even going so good at the railroad station, I got promoted to assistant engineer, which meant I got to ride on the train sometimes so far out of town I'd be gone overnight. They even gave me a pistol so as to ward off any troublemakers along the tracks. Then this one time, on one of them long-distance trips all the way to Tennessee, a train broke down in front of us and we had no choice but to go back to Calhoun. I showed up at our shack in the middle of the night and snuck in real quiet-like, so as to not wake up Peggy. But when I went to crawl into bed, I felt a body in my spot. "What in holy hell?" I yelled, and a feller sat up with a fright, and Peggy screamed. Pure terror felt like silk snaking down my spine. I flicked on the bedroom light and saw Peggy throwing herself over my brother Donald like a naked quilt. "Ain't what it looks like, misfit," she screamed, lying through them pretty little teeth of hers. Because when she said misfit, I could see Donald's lips twitch as if they itching to smile. And ladies and gentlemen, that's what did it. Hearing our secret nickname said in such a way as I knew it weren't no secret no more. Hell, probably never was. So I whipped that pistol out of my belt and fired till the gun gave out. Pillow feathers, bits of bed frame, and blood was all I could see. Once the smoke settled, I looked down that pistol in my hand, and my heart got to stomping. Was a funny feeling, like having the first drink of water after sweating in a ditch since sunup, and all my fear and trembling had done up and left. The Apostle Paul said in the Bible, "In him we have redemption through the blood." And then I knew, Lord have mercy in Christ Almighty, I was saved. And me and that pistol that killed my family, guess you could put it, was love at first shot.
Name's George Borman. And I've been called a lot of things in my life. Thief, addict, degenerate, rapist. But now I am called chosen. I am the elect. I am a disciple of the one true God and a follower of his son. I was washed in his blood and I am now set free. Hallelujah. Now I know y'all heard about what I done. Read about it in the papers. Seen it on your TV. Heard it through the grapevine. But I ain't never done nothing to a man who ain't had it coming. And I tell you, that man deserved every bit of what I'd done to him. Now, when I was a young man, my daddy always told me to stay where I belonged. Daddy was a God-fearing man. Preached at the Church of God's Holiness up there on State Route 3. Spoke in tongues and held venomous serpents unharmed, miraculously protected by the power of the Holy Ghost. But I was a stubborn child. Daddy tried to raise me upright. But I had a darkness in me that endured through my teenage years. Now I would stray. "There ain't nothing for you down there in that city," he'd tell me. Well, I wouldn't have none of it. Around 14 years old, got into pot, pills, the insane clown posse with a buddy of mine named Cody. We'd get ripped, listen to them albums over and over again. One day, late July, we heard this band would be performing in Atlanta, playing at that Jew place, the Tabernacle. Well, they was going to go on around 10 or so we had a little time to get messed up for the concert. God help us. I'd stole a few 40s from the Chevron. We weren't old enough at that time to buy our own booze. So we was drinking on the way down to the concert. Cody's driving his daddy's truck, and we's passing a 40 back and forth. We're both out of our head on Xanax, and Cody could barely keep the truck pointed in the right direction. Well, turns out Hall County had a warrant out for Cody's daddy. When that sheriff pulled us over, he already had his sights leveled against us. Cody's daddy had apparently done that sheriff wrong, and he recognized that particular truck as belonging to the man who had been forcefully familiar with his stepdaughter. Cody seen them flashing lights, pulled the truck over, but that cop, he pulled Cody through the window before he could even speak up. Beat the Jesus out of him out there on the shoulder, but I wasn't reacting too quick because of the booze and the pills. When I finally registered Cody screaming out there on the side of the road, I stumbled out of the truck. Second cop was on me instantly. Pulled his gun, cracked me a good one across the back of the head. I went down. I don't remember nothing. Woke up in lockdown. Hall County Pen. Cody been up for a while trying to clean the gravel out of the back of my head with his shirt and some commode water. We was caged up with maybe 20 other souls, all looking deranged, dope sick. Spent about a day and a half in there, feeling weak, getting screamed at by the cops and inmates alike. Them cops, they'd drag their nightsticks across the bars and yell all manner of nasty things at us. They'd rile up the black folks, tell them to swing on us white boys. Me and Cody fought to save our lives in that holding cell. Now this was before the Lord had humbled me. I wanted so bad to be my own man, but ain't nothing for you there kept rattling around in my head. I didn't want my daddy to be right, but I knew he was. Eventually, I went and stood before the judge. I didn't know what to expect, but I had a feeling it was going to be bad news. I'd put my bottle of pills in Cody's glove box, and I just knew those animals had torn that truck apart. Well, the judge say we had drugs on us, and that the bond was set at $7,000 or $8,000 apiece. Ain't no one in my town had that kind of money, so we was just gonna rot. Dressed us up in orange, led us away. 3 years they gave us. 3 years locked away with the worst imaginable scum of the earth that had done all manner of wicked things to be in there. Maniacs, kitty touchers, murderers, the damned. Well, we did our best in there, but we had targets on our backs. We was young, white, inexperienced. Fight as I did, I learned in that prison that what a man was capable of doing to another man. That I could be made another man's lady. When we was released, we still didn't feel free. Me and Cody made it back up to Denton in disgrace. And I never really talked about what happened to us. I knew, though. I saw it in Cody's eyes. I heard it in his voice. We was broken men. I tried to get a job once I got back, but ain't nobody looking to hire no 20-something junkie felon. I had a reputation now. I went back to my daddy's trailer and started getting high and drunk for weeks at a time. But the money just wasn't there to support it. Try as I could, I just couldn't figure out how to fit into this disgusting mess of a world. So I started spending more and more of my time out in the woods. At first, it was just out of necessity. I needed food, so I'd hunt, fish, and trap. Then, as time went on, I just started spending more and more of my time out there. An overnight would turn into 3 or 4 days. Sometimes that week would turn into a month. My life, as they would say in my daddy's meetings, had become unmanageable. I began to pull away. "Ain't nothing for you down there," my daddy said. Now, I know he meant it about the city, but I started to understand that there weren't nothing for me nowhere. Nowhere but the woods. Now, the last time I left Denton, my daddy turned a kind eye to me. I don't know what moved him to do so. He never really took much of an interest in me after what I'd done. But he laid this Bible in my hands and gave me a stern look. "You ain't never gonna find what you're looking for out there, boy," he told me. "But you will in here." Now, while I was detoxing out there in the wilderness, I read his holy word cover to cover more times than I can count. The Lord revealed himself to me, and I became close with him. I was cleansed of all my iniquity and sanctified in his holy name. I was baptized in my isolation. I was the prodigal son returned by forsaking my life and walking with him in the solitude. I was returned to a fold of one. Now I know y'all's wondering how such an isolated, contented, holy man such as myself came to be paraded across the front pages of newspapers and thrust into your living rooms via satellite dish. The Blue Ridge Monster, that's what they called me. weren't no fault of my own, though. That man was ignorant of where he stood, and the Lord, working through me, purged him of his wickedness. I was setting a gill net out in Denton Creek, trying to catch me some of God's bounty. Must have been out in the woods 3 years going at this point. I had not seen nor talked to a mortal soul during that time. And that's when I saw Tyler Alexander Roche. I'd later be told he was an attorney up from Midtown on a canoeing trip. But I knew right then and there from the looks of him, he did not belong in our woods. He was a young sinner on a lark in my Lord's holy domain, and we just could not abide that. Over the 3 days I stalked him, the Lord communicated directly to me that just as the unclean were rejected from the Holy of Holies, so too must this man be destroyed. He was putting on his life jacket when I sneaked up on him, looped that gill net round his throat and strangled him with the strength of Samson. While he struggled and gasped, I laid into him like those boys back in lockup had laid into me. His broken, defiled flesh was Sodom, and I was the cleansing brimstone from heaven. In the chaos, I recall him trying to scramble away. Like Cain before me, I broke his back with a heavy stone. It took a few hours, but when his eyes finally rolled over in the back of his head, I knew I was both the crucifixion and the resurrection. His gurglings and moans were in tongues. But I swear to you, before I cut his throat from ear to ear and bled him dry, he thanked me for redeeming him.
This is Elizabeth Jarrett, Eudora Welty's The Ponder Heart. As Bonnie D. Peacock, I should say. How strange it is to have a house full of company. After I met Daniel and became a ponder, life was akin to being locked up tight in a barrel. People waiting for you to ferment like a grape before they shared you with their friends over Sunday supper. Usually not a soul in this big old house but me and that fuzzy chicken out front. And the help, of course. Old Man Ponder and his wife liked the isolation up on this hill. They filled room after room with more furniture than a department store, a far cry from growing up in Polk. Polk was hardly what you'd call a city, even by Mississippi standards. If you was traveling east on Highway 60 and sneezed at just the right moment, you were liable to miss it. The only road we got wasn't much more than a pile of gravel up by the church. Baptist, of course. I was right smack in the middle of 10 children altogether. We always were watermelon people. Our neighbors in Polk said that if you cut any of us open, you'd find seeds inside. All day long, the Peacock boys harvested watermelon, and the Peacock girls sold watermelon, and in between, we ate watermelon. Did you know you can make watermelon stew? It's thick and stringy like the moss on the trees, with just about as much flavor as that, too. Well, being right in the middle of all them peacocks, I would have been forgotten about had it not been for what Mama called my exceptional genealogy. Those were the only two big words Mama knew, words as big as she was around. Uncle told me I was the only pretty peacock there ever was. Everyone said I wasn't any bigger than a minute, so small you couldn't blow me a kiss without sweeping me away. I liked Poke enough, but in the movies, beautiful women were always doing something, riding in the back of taxis or crying on a velvet sofa. I was a beautiful woman at 17, and I wanted to do something. But people never left Polk, so we never learned how to say goodbye. I just ran up the road like the devil was after me and caught the first bus going anywhere. And that's how I wound up in Clay. Got a job counting nickels in the 10-cent store. Well, I heard tale of the Ponders, particularly Daniel. He was not one to shy away from the spotlight and had a reputation for foolishly giving away all of his family's possessions. When he wandered into the 10-cent that day, in the same giant white Stetson he always wore, I took notice. He was in the middle of telling some long-winded story when I caught his eye from across the beauty counter. I batted my eyelashes like they were putting out a fire. I don't know why. He certainly was no stallion and had at least 20 years on me. But I suppose I had nothing better to do just right at that very moment. Well, that Daniel Ponder marched right on over to me and said, "I've got a great big house standing empty and my father's Studebaker. Come on, marry me." Mom always told me never to say no to a man who asks you to marry him, because you might not ever get the chance again. One time, these beautiful Oxfords came into the 10-cent store. I saved up a whole month to buy them, but wasn't sure if I wanted to commit to them or not. Mr. Barfield told me I could take them home for a trial run. That way, I could make sure they were what I really wanted before I spent all that money. So, that's what I offered Daniel Ponder, a trial marriage. Daniel's niece and only living relative, Edna Earle, ran the family's Beulah Hotel right in the heart of Clay. She was what Mama would call a dandelion, pretty until the wind blows away all the seeds and there's just a stem left. Well, her and Daniel were so close they might as well have shared a womb. They shared just about everything but our marriage bed. Daniel had so little backbone, I'm surprised he could stand. But he treated me nice enough, I reckon. He could never stay far away from people for too long on account of his compulsive, given nature. So day after day, I had this big empty place all to myself. I went from one room to another with nothing better to do than wait while he played St. Nicholas to all of Clay. I decided this trial marriage was adjourned. He stayed at the Beulah and still sent me $25 a week. Well, never having had any money to myself before, I spent. I had anything and everything I wanted. I bought a telephone without anyone to call, and I even bought pants, just to see what it felt like to do a cartwheel and not have your skirt fly over your head. That was the best time in my life. When the money stopped, I was in a conniption. I knew Daniel the Jellyfish wasn't bold enough for that. He had the personality of a dish rag. Edna Earle. She always thought I was dumber than a bag of hammers. That Bonnie D never smiles. That's because the sight of her made my face squinch up like I sucked on a lemon. Jealousy, that's what it was. If she had one more wrinkle, she could screw her hat on. I would march myself down to the Beulah and show her I had more words than she had dollars, and I would do it with a smile. Daniel Ponder sent word before I could raise Cain. "I'm going to kill you dead, Miss Bonnie D, if you don't take me back." He couldn't have known those words would come back to haunt him. Now, at the trial, lies grew quicker than kudzu. I'm going to tell you the way everybody else heard it. So I sent for Daniel come Monday and was dead come Monday afternoon. At first, everyone labeled it death by misadventure. I always liked the way that sounded, like one of those classic foreign films you have to read while you're watching. Or word got back about Daniel's note, the one about killing me, and Daddy Peacock filed the charges. I and everybody else knew that Daniel didn't mean anything by it. That's a thing of love. I'm going to skin you alive, I love you so much. It was just the Ponder way. It did look suspicious, though, seeing as I was deader in a doornail not 2 days later. Some conjectured that Daniel hugged me so hard, squeezed all the air right out of me. Another story had a giant fireball racing through the parlor, scaring me to death. Well, I admit that might have done it, but the real story is much more interesting. Daniel and Edna Earle arrived just as the big storm was starting. The Ponders were all afraid of electricity and told so many stories of the terror it caused that they had just about everyone else scared of it, too. Being that I had caught the Ponder fear of lightning strike, I was beside myself, bawling my little eyes out. Daniel, being how he was, started tickling my leg and slowly moved up my body as I wailed on the couch. I was so scared that those little tickles mixed with the deadly fear of electrocution were too much for my sweetheart to handle. I laughed and laughed until I just up and died. Dumb old Edna Earle didn't lift a finger to stop it. All that time together and Daniel Ponder never made me laugh once. I guess all that pent-up laughter was just bottled up inside me waiting to get out. I plumb laughed myself to death. Daniel took the stand and for the first time in his life was speechless. So he did the only thing he knew how. Gave. That fool walked into the middle of that courtroom and opened his bloated jacket, which was stuffed with every penny his family had passed on to him. He threw money like confetti, and the courtroom went mad for it. People forget to be ashamed of themselves when money is involved. Daniel was found not guilty, but Mama and Daddy Peacock and all those other peacock fingers present got a nice sum of Daniel's givings. I think they're living in Silver City now. I hear they have a Studebaker.
Welcome back to the podcast. I'm here with John and Laura. We hope you enjoyed that reading of Born Under a Bad Sign, the latest, well, not the latest, the second volume of the Transgression Literary Series. The latest is
Mass Hysteria.
Mass Hysteria. Thank you, John. Well, we're about to wrap up, but I did want to make sure that you both had a chance to talk about what you're doing individually, but also with Transgression, and let all of our listeners know how they can get involved, learn more, and be ready for the next volume.
Cool. Well, we're currently plotting.
Plotting.
plotting for the for all of 2016. For the first three Transgressions, we kind of did them on a case-by-case basis and just kind of touched base after we wrapped on one. But this year, we're kind of taking an overarching, like, approach to the entire year. So we are beefing up our team. Do we have a specific email address or anything where people can reach us?
We don't yet, actually. Okay. Yeah. We
we will have one shortly.
They'll call you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Don't email
Find
them.
Us.
They'll email you.
It's a secret handshake if we'll stop you in the street. Yeah, we've decided really with, you know, whenever you start any kind of endeavor like this, you're really not sure if you're going to get past volume one, you know. And we really enjoyed volume one, which was Clue. And, you know, they carried us through, this whole entire 2015. And we enjoyed it enough where we sat down and just had a brainstorming meeting and, you know, kind of asked the question, do we want to keep doing this? And, you know, I think we both resoundingly said yes. And so with that being said, you know, we really just planned out for what we're going to do. But we're going to turn Transgression more into kind of a collective and give different artists and creatives an opportunity to be able to work with us in 2016 to pull off bigger and better volumes and just get people involved in the art community, involved with Dear Bear Wolf, because, like you said, Transgression is a Dear Bear Wolf's reading series. That's kind of the basic gist of it. But, yeah, don't call us. We'll call you.
Yeah. We're on the prowl for, like, set designers and copywriters and
makeup artists.
Makeup artists.
Yeah, yeah.
And things.
Lots of things, it seems
so many
like.
Things. Yeah.
All right. Last question for the both of you. What is your favorite thing about your involvement with Transgression?
Oh, man. The first run through. The great thing about working with all these writers is we give them the prompt, and, like, if they ask us questions, we answer. But then we, like, really leave it to them. So the first walkthrough, like, we know what our role is and how to introduce them, but we literally have no idea what to expect. And every single time, I'm so amazed by the level of intricacy and effort that our performers and creatives put into their pieces. And so, like, we're experiencing it for the first time just like our audiences. So hopefully, like, I contain my excitement for that enough that, like, maybe people don't know it's the first time I'm seeing it until right now when I'm telling the world. But that's my favorite part, is just seeing it come to life, because that's our raison d'etre. That's the whole reason I want to do this.
Yeah.
How about you, Johnny?
You know, there's – mine definitely falls in that. I might cheat a little bit here. I think it's just really interesting to take – writers and put them in this situation to see them raise their game, going along with what Laura was saying. One thing that we focus on is also trying to get new writers who've never done a reading before to participate. So to see them not just do a reading, but to do a Transgression is pretty insane, you know, and it raises their game. But I'd probably say my favorite thing about it is I enjoy that first run, but while we're hosting the ones that are truly the walkthroughs, which Clue and Born Under a Bad Sign were, is when we host them in groups. So you're going to go through with a group of 10 to 15 people. And historically, we have been the hosts of those groups. So we might take a group, different groups through, you know, potentially 3 to 4 times a piece. Mm-hmm. And what's really cool is the third or fourth time that I go through and I see the writers tweak their pieces and get better at delivering it and become even more the character than they were the first go round. That's really interesting too. So that's probably my favorite part of it. I really enjoy seeing that.
Mm-hmm. All right. John Carroll and Laura Relier, the co-curators of Transgression. John, Laura, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.